Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in, since they going back to showing action tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the anime action fan sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative, right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your primetime host, Thomas Primetime Madison, and I welcome you all back as we celebrate the second annual Disney Month here on the Absolution Network. This is episode 49, one away from episode 50, and on this episode, we are going to be covering one of probably the most underappreciative Disney animated movies in its history. This movie came out the mid to late 1980s. It came out after the debacle, which is a word I just made up, but, you know, debacle, then there's a B word that I just combined the two because it's so massive of a screw-up. And even though I heard there's a director's cut out there somewhere, that makes it somewhat watchable, but after what was the Black Cauldron, you know, Disney set off to get their shit together. And this movie came out during that time, and it's pretty much overlooked alongside Oliver and Company and Rescuers Down Under. Of course, I am talking about The Great Mouse Detective, a Walt Disney animated movie that came out in 1986. And it's pretty much based off everything you love about Sherlock Holmes. Hence the whole Great Mouse Detective. And there's a lot of good stuff in this movie. You know, the animation, you know, I watched it on HDTV, still kind of holds. It shows its age, but it's still very good. You know, it kind of like how Secret of Nim shows its age. Again, but in this case, it's not a bad thing, but we'll talk more about that when we get to review. But yeah, again, this is a very hectic time for Disney. Black Cauldron was a failure by all means. And of course, this was a time of revolution and changes coming at Disney. This was the time where, God, I wish I could, I'm blanking on his name right now. And I hate it. Will Eisner. I do believe I'm getting right. But Will Eisner had just taken over the company with the other gentleman whose name is escaping me. And I should know this as somebody who tries to be a fan of Disney. But you know me with names. And this is, of course, around the time that Jeffrey Katzenberg was appointed by Will Eisner. Welcome back, folks. If you've heard the little star shape there, that's because, again, I could not help myself. But it was Michael Eisner was the name I was thinking of. But you know, Michael Eisner appointed Jeffrey Katzenberg, as the new, head honcho in charge of the Disney animation department. It was actually around the time they were finishing up production on Black Cauldron. He's the one who actually patched it up. But from there, they did a movie every year, and they really started to change away with things like Oliver and Company, which I actually like, though admittedly, the most thing I remember about Oliver and Company is the great Billy Joel songs, including Why Should I Worry? Why Should I Care? Then I Have Cause I Got Streets That Walk There. And that's a horrible rendition of that song, and I apologize, I should do better. But anyways, The Great Mouse Detective, as we're going to be talking about tonight, came out, and would eventually lead to The Little Mermaid. The other important thing is, again, a lot of the people who would be instrumental in, all the great stuff that would come to Disney with The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, all of this stuff, their first works, when we talked about first on Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but this was when they were really starting to be integrated into the company, people like Andres Deja and Mark Henn and Glenn Keane, who had been there for a couple of years. He's probably the oldest person of that big new group. And all these great animators, Ron Husband. There's one name I'm blanking on. Person who did Belle. And help with James Baxter, all these great animators. This is their beginnings, and this is where they're starting to dab their feet. And while they were successful with Who Framed Roger Rabbit, they were successful to an extent with Oliver and Company and the Great Mouse Detective, but not as successful as they would be down the road. It was really. You could see the talent. You could see the rumblings of what could be. It just, they didn't have all the pieces able to fit together. And it wasn't until Little Mermaid till they really did all fit together. Again, this is Ron Clements and John Musker's first directorial debut. Which doesn't make any sense because you can only have one directorial debut. But this was their directorial debut. And their first film that they directed for Disney, they also did the worked on the screenplay. And like I said, it's a great movie. It's very much overlooked. I think at the end of the day, and something you'll hear me talk a lot about with this movie, is that this is a film that is made for people who love movies. Very much kind of like from what I hear, Hugo was made for people who sort of love cinema and love movies. There is a very cinematic feel to this movie that sort of takes you back to sort of the old Sherlock Holmes sort of vignettes and TV series and movies and radio shows and sort of the classic stories of Sherlock Holmes. Again, because it is based off that stuff, but it really does help to capture that cinematic feel of Sherlock Holmes. Again, this being based off a book called Baker Street. A wonderful composer again, added some great music, just a lot of good stuff. And again, I think it's important for a lot of people to check out this film. Again, you're to see, this is the beginnings of the stuff that we would see really in that next movie, The Little Mermaid, because that was the next movie. And again, I think the hardest thing for me with this review tonight is going to be not to compare it to The Little Mermaid, because it, Oliver and Company, The Great Mouse Detective, and I really do throw Rescuers Down Under, which is a good movie upon itself, but was really between The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast. But in with this group, these three movies were really sort of the in-between of two different eras of Walt Disney. Again, that first one being what the Black Cauldron was part of, what we saw with Robin Hood and Sword and Stone, The Jungle Book, a lot of those movies, while probably beloved and that stuff, not up to the same measuring stick as things like Sleeping Beauty and Peter Pan, and Alice in Wonderland and Snow White and Cinderella, you know. I always look at this as really three main eras of Walt Disney that have been so far, technically four. But you have that first era, you know, Snow White up to Sleeping Beauty, and then you have sort of a 20-year period of lows for Disney. Then, of course, the re-rise of, you know, with Little Mermaid, and then Golden Renaissance with the 90s. And then, of course, you have sort of today's period, which has been taken over by Pixar, which is a whole different discussion and rant by me for another day. And, of course, really, these three movies were sort of that in-between stuff that really helped these animators and these future directors dab their feet, you know, get experience, which I think really helped allow them to make stuff like Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Lion King and all of those movies wonderful. Two of which, by the way, we are going to be reviewing in the next 2 weeks. You'll just have to stick around to find out what those are, but, you know, let's get right into, because I'm talking a lot about it, and I'll probably talk more about it later. Let's get right into the review. Let's go on with our synopsis. Of course, we have no emails or comments to talk about at this time. But thank you. You know, I have been checking, and I know a lot of you are listening, so thank all of you who do listen. But let's get right into our plot synopsis, shall we? In London, circa 1897, a young Scottish mouse named Olivia Flesham, if Basil can't get it right, neither do I, should I say. So don't knock me on that. But she is celebrating her birthday with her toy maker father, Hiram. Suddenly, Fidget, a bat with a peg leg, takes him to Professor Radigan, the world's most dastardly villain in all of Mousedom, who commands him to create a clockwork robot which would mimic the Queen of Mice so Radigan can rule England. Radigan initially refuses to participate in the scheme, whereupon Radigan threatens to harm Olivia. It also may have something to do with the mouse who called Radigan a rat and fed him to his pet cat, which I say...
He died? And this is supposed to be a kid's movie!
Thank you, Rizzo! Meanwhile, Olivia is searching to find the fabled Basil of Baker Street, the world-famous detective and Radigan's arch-nemesis. Returning to London after a tour of duty, at the same time, from Afghanistan, Dr. David Q. Dawson stumbles upon Olivia and helps her find the Basil residence. They meet the quirky Basil, who is on the hunt for a notorious criminal, and at first Basil is reluctant, but when Olivia mentions Fidget, Basil now recognizes that this is his chance to capture Radigan. Therefore, Basil, along with Olivia and Dawson, take Toby, Sherlock Holmes' pet dog, and go on the hunt for Fidget and Radigan. This is the Great Mouse Detective. And welcome back, and let's get right into it as we should with our review. And of course, we always start with music, and let's start with the opening and closing theme. I'm going to say here that the composer of the music for this movie, again, a very, very well-known composer, Enrico Nicola Henry Mancini, probably best known for the iconic jazz theme to the Pink Panther film series and the theme to the Peter Gunn television series as well. You know, the dun da 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 Of course, I probably remember the theme for the more of the Pink Panther animated shorts. He's also worked on things like Breakfast at Tiffany's, and among other things. And he's won Academy Awards and Grammys as well. But he did the score, and you know what? Again, what I like most about his score, and again, we're starting here with the opening closing theme. It can be seen right in the opening and the closing theme to an extent. With the opening theme, again, this bomb, you have that initial attack, and then it goes to the credits, and it's this very bombastic adventure theme, as you heard just a couple minutes ago. And just this sort of grand, bombastic, a lot of brass, and, here we go on the adventure. And it just, sort of very, sort of classic cinematic theme for a sort of adventure or mystery type of movie, at least more in the traditional sense of kind of how it was maybe more back, I'm going to use the term, in the olden days. And I sort of love the throwback quality to that theme. Like I said, the hardest thing is not comparing it to Little Mermaid, because then you have Alan Menken and the others who... I'm really blanking on names tonight, and I apologize. I know they're slowing down on the film, and I'm stumbling over myself, but back to the review. A very much of a throwback theme, very bombastic, very much of a cinematic theme, to say. And I do love it for that standpoint. It's just, it's very unique, and it is something to where if I think I heard it out of the blue, I'd say, what's that sound? And I'd probably think for a couple minutes, like, and then move on, and then realize 5 minutes later, that's the theme to The Great Mouse Detective. So it's not... Maybe not immediately recognized in the poll, because it's a throwback and it's very traditional in that sense, but it does have its ability to stand on its own, possibly after a couple minutes. And then you have the closing theme, which half of it is just a rehash of the opening theme. And then it's them singing Goodbye, Farewell, which is a song that Radigan sings on a record. In the middle of the movie when he has Basil and Dawson trapped. That's part of a trap of his, but this is more of a choir sort of singing. So long, farewell. Da, 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 da. It itself is very much of a throwback in itself. It feels like a throwback to sort of those classic sort of Disney ending songs, which is one of the few good things of the 70s. Again, it feels like sort of the throwback ending songs that you would see in things like Peter Pan and Alice in Wonderland and The Jungle Book and The Sword in the Stone. Really a throwback to that. And I like it for them. It's sort of the old, keeping sort of the Disney tradition alive there. Like I said, just very much throwbacks, very much traditional in that sense. And then you have the overall score, and just a wonderful score. I think hitting a lot of the right notes for an adventure theme. It's very funny. I've been thinking about this film for about 24 hours, and initially my thoughts were, am I really impressed by it? And I just had to keep going over and over and over it again. But again, it's one of those things to where just hits all the right notes. It's really a lot of good, interesting, and just very unique and wonderful themes. Again, that cinematic feel, very traditional, very much of a throwback upon itself. A lot of the music at the end, the sort of sky airship chasing scene, the music during sort of the Big Ben fight. All through the Big Ben fight, when they're in the clock tower, when they're out of the clock tower, and sort of that final fight, very deafening and dramatic and everything, and Radigan, you know, he can deliver the final blow, and yet they all get knocked off and everything, but Basil makes it out alive. Spoiler alert for those who've never seen this movie. By the way, Darth Vader is Luke's dad. Sorry. I don't even know why I say spoiler alert, because I never do it either. But, you know, in that standpoint, again, Lazarus themes, the songs themselves I just feel are okay, and I think that's the weakest part of the musical score, is that while the orchestra part is very strong, I think sort of the individual song parts are okay. You know, the Radigan song is probably the best song in this movie. It's a very well-done sort of villain song. It's Radigan just being egotistical and everything. And again, leads to the infamous, hey, we're going to off somebody in the first 10 minutes of the movie. Again, I point to Rizzo's quote earlier. the other songs, I just think, leave something to be desired. And I just think are the weakest part of the score. But outside of that, the music, you know, in the background, again, it doesn't have that perfect blend, that perfect balance I would like to see in a movie. But again, that's because this score is really a throwback to sort of the old school scores, where they are more bombastic and they are more out front as part of the film. They just aren't the type of music I like to, or at least the balance to the music that I would like as part of a film. But outside of that, it's really, really good. And so I have to acknowledge that, while it's not my cup of tea, it's not that it's bad. It's very good. It's just, it's not the type of thing I like to see in a movie. With that, let's move on to animation. And with our first talking point in animation, of course, we're going to talk about the overall style. And again, like, you know, I was hinting at it, you know, in the introduction as I was talking about this film. You know, again, those pieces, those, you see the inkling of what's to come. You know, you see the talent of Andres Deja and a lot of the animators that come, you know, Glenn Keane and Marquen. You know, Glenn Keane and Marquen, in fact, were, I think, artistic supervisors on this film. You know, Black Cauldron, Oliver and Company, and The Great Mouse Detective, I think, were actually... It's hard, because again, I'm going back to a documentary. There's a great Disney documentary called Waking Sleeping Beauty that looks into the you know, the resurrection of Walt Disney animation in the late 80s with Little Mermaid. And, you know, kind of what stopped it. There's, another name I'm blanking on again. I'm going to leave it at that. But it's just a great documentary. It's just wonderful. And I know around the time in the mid-80s, there was a lot of animators. I think one of which, in fact, was... I can't believe I'm blanking on his name. But the creator for Secret of Nim and Thumbelina and Fievel. I hate that I'm forgetting his name. I should know his name, but it's despicable me. But I know him and a lot of other people who were working for Disney had left at the time. At some time in the 80s. And so it was that there was a lot of sort of young, new guys, like the guys I've been talking about. And again, like I said, really that first name, because they've been working on it since the early to mid-80s, was Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Really successful with that stuff. And then, of course, you have Oliver and Company and The Great Mouse Detective. And you see inklings of that return to that classic Disney style in the overall style. But at the end of the day, the overall style, again, it's that... It is that sort of 80s, 70s Disney style. That's the animation overall is great. I think it's aged in the fact that it's, like I said, it's that 70s, 80s type of Disney animation style. Now, it's high quality and it's at its top of its game. But again, it's just, it's of its age. You know, you heard me use that term for the first season of Lupin the Third. Again, the animation is of that age. Again, that difference between great animation that is timeless and great animation that is of its age. You know, it's... There's some years on it, is what I'm saying. But it's very, very good. I can't deny that. And I do enjoy it. Again, cartoon style here. Not a lot of use of shadows. All the classic things that point to it being a cartoon are there. You know, it's interesting to think about this film and then think about Fievel and Fievel Goes West. You know, again, sort of, it's that class sort of, hey, let's use mice as the main characters and we're in that small sort of version of the human world. Another thing to talk about the overall style is, again, this was the first use of the CAPS system that Disney created. You know, computer animated program system. Or computer assistance program system, I think it's called. It's one of the two. But of course, this being in the clock tower scene, where they use computer graphics and CGI to, you know, help with the animation. Something that would go on to create wonderful scenes in movies like Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. So this film, if for nothing else, is important historically for just the use of that system. But, you know, the overall animation is just, it really is good to look at. You know, all things aside about age and everything, I do enjoy the animation. I think the animators did a great job. And again, you see, it's not quite to the quality that they would need yet, or at least they weren't able to quite capture yet. And I think some pushes in the right direction during the production of The Little Mermaid helped that in certain artistic decisions, as we talked about last year. But again, just a really good, you know, simple cartoon style movie done with this animation. Let's move on to character designs. And again, I really do like the character designs. Olivia, I can, yeah, here or there. But, you know, I love Basil's design. You know, everything about him screams what a classic sort of Sherlock Holmes look is supposed to be. And I'm not just talking about with the hat and sort of the garb. You know, even when he's in disguise or pretty, you know, I'm talking about in the face. So even though it's a mouse, sort of the slimness of these characters and everything, it just screams Sherlock Holmes. The way they posture him throughout the movie screams Sherlock Holmes. You know, it's very funny. You look at some of the postures he used and then watch a movie like Sherlock Holmes from a couple years ago, you know, with why am I blanking on names? Robert Downey Jr. I am horrible tonight. This is going to be the cosign of this episode. The review of The Great Mouse Detective, the review where Thomas forgot every name he tried to remember. But, you know, if you look at Robert Downey Jr.'s performance, I think you see sort of the same postures and everything that you would see here, and it's very interesting. Again, those postures really do establish sort of that Sherlock Holmes character. Professor Radigan, just, I think, a great villain. It's just this, almost this sort of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde sort of combined. You know, the body of a Mr. Hyde with the sophistication of a Dr. Jekyll, almost. Just this sly, creepy, scary look that I very much enjoy. You know, Dawson, just sort of that classic Watson feel to it. You know, with Toby, again, Basset Hound. Needed to be a Basset Hound. Wonderfully drawn Basset Hound. We'll get into voice in a second. But, you know, pretty much everything about the character designs, I pretty much really liked, you know. I think it hit everything on the mark and hit every note that the animation, at least for the character designs, need to hit. Sort of capture that sort of classic sort of, not just mystery feel, but that classic Sherlock Holmes feel. Because again, with the animation and everything about this movie going back to the sort of the same inspiration that the book had, Basil of Baker Street, which was, again, those sort of classic Sherlock Holmes movies and television series from the 30s and 40s. Again, special effects, it's, you know, again, with special effects, again, when cartoons are not that very big, but the ones that I did see here, dust and everything, really well done. But the really, again, the big special effects is the first use of the CAPS program. The scene in the clock tower, it's a great final battle scene for a Disney movie, and just the way they use the CAPS systems for the gears and everything was just wonderful. Again, it's aged a bit because it's the first used and everything, but it's still wonderful to look at just on that technical level. I really enjoy looking at it from that standpoint. And then, of course, you have the backgrounds. Backgrounds are gorgeous. You know, they're in only a few locations, but they make it seem like many. And just the different locations in the backgrounds, you know, being at the riverfront, being on Baker Street, you know, Radigan's hideout, the Royal Palace, which leads to one of my favorite funny moments I'll get to in story. You know, the Big Ben Tower, the London Bridge, you know, so many wonderful backgrounds. And, you know, Disney, I think, has always done London beautifully. You know, London is such a, can be such a mysterious and unique entity upon itself. You know, and when you use it as a background, that mystique, I think, sometimes helps out in making that background really, really well. And it's no different here, but the animation is, you know, with top-notch animation, I should say, with that mystique, just wonderful, wonderful backgrounds. With that, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to dive into acting and story. So we'll be right back, folks.
In the decade of the 1930s, even the great city of Cleveland, Ohio, was not spared the ravages of the Great Depression. In a time of fear and confusion, a character emerged that would entertain and inspire millions of children and adults alike. He began not as flesh and blood, but as a simple line drawing. His comic book adventures thrilled millions around the world. The magic of radio gave to his name a breathless signature and sound. Then with television came a whole new generation to idolize his exploits. In the 70s, the world believed a man could fly. In the 80s, he was reborn in the comics, and the 90s saw his death, rebirth, and marriage. In the 21st century, he returned to the big screen and saw his origin changed and retold on several occasions. Through the decades, he has gone by many names. The Man of Tomorrow, the Last Son of Krypton, the Man of Steel. His strength is incredible. His name is legendary. His battle is never ending. Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound.
My name is Michael Bailey, and I host an internet radio show called Views from the Long Box. Superman is my favorite character of all time, and in 2013, he is turning 75. Because of this, a large portion of the episodes this year will be about the Man of Steel in a series I'm calling
Superman at 75, the celebration of a legend.
I'm going to mark Superman's birthday in fine style by examining all aspects of the character's history, from the comics, to the movies, to the television series, and beyond, both alone and with the best and brightest of the podcasting world. may not be every episode, but the bulk of Views in 2013 will be all about the Man of Steel. He is the first and greatest superhero of them all, and he deserves no less.
Superman at 75, the celebration of a legend.
A series within a series, and the biggest birthday card a fan can give his favorite hero, only at Views from the Long Box. Views from the Long Box is a Fortress of Baileytude production. New episodes drop every other Tuesday over at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com, and for this series, over at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
Ready to form Voltron!
I am Batman!
This is a job for Superman!
Power Rangers!
Right away, Michael.
Autobots, transform!
By the power of Grayskull!
For the honor of Grayskull!
Hello. I'm the Doctor.
Charlie's Geekcast. Coming January 1st, 2013 to www.charliesgeekcast.com.
And welcome back, and let's get right back into it, shall we, with acting. And let's go over our cast list. We have Barry Ingram as Basil himself, the main character. Vincent Price as Professor Ratigan, which immediately means I love this movie. Val Bettigan as Major Dr. David Q. Dawson. Suzanne Palestic as Olivia Flasham. Candy Candino as Fidget, Ratchkin's bubbling bat henchman. Frank Weckler plays Toby and Felicia, the cat and dog, because, let's face it, if it's a dog or any type of animal in a movie, it's probably Frank Weckler. As Scott McNeil once said, you know, Hollywood likes Frank Weckler because he takes direction better. And he doesn't leave poop stains all over the rug. Alan Young as Hiram Flasham. Diane Chesney as Miss Judson. Eva Brenner as Queen Mousetoria. Barry Ingram also has another role in the movie. He's Bartholomew. He's the mouse who gets devoured by Felicia early on in the movie. And there's a Sherlock Holmes and a Dr. Watson. They have cameo roles. Dr. Watson is played by Laurie Maine. But the Sherlock Holmes role is actually sound clips taken from the 1930s and 1940s Sherlock Holmes movies. And is actually the voice of the star of those films, Basil Rathbone. Again, who is the person that Basil himself is actually based off of, or at least his name is taken from. So, with acting, you know, very well done. It's... I'm mixed. There are some people who I love. Again, going to Miss Suzanne Palestic as Olivia, I thought she was okay. Same thing for Val Bettigan. You know, I thought he did an okay job as Dawson. But really, the star of this movie was definitely both Ratigan and Basil, and they were the two best voices. And it does overcome, I think, some of the, you know, not that I'm saying Frank Weckler did a bad job, because he never does a bad job, but again, he was the dog and the cat. I'm not going to see her talk about the intricacies of the acting of a dog and a cat. But, you know, again, you have Barry Ingram and Vincent Price. Really, they're the two main characters here. And unlike different times where I sort of separate villain and hero, I can't, because within acting here, it really is the way that they're able to play off each other. That's really, really incredible. Again, Vincent Price, do I need to say more? The legendary actor himself, he is in love with this role. He is bombastic. He is egotistical. He just enjoys being evil. And what better than the master of evil himself to be evil? And then, of course, you know, Basil himself, you know, Barry puts this small bit of egotism, no, wow, that word just snuck up on me. Egotism, egotism, and I'm, wow, yeah, I can't speak English tonight, folks. But, you know, his egotistic and, you know, how it consumes him a bit, as I try to walk around that word, but yeah, with, you know, he's been egotistic himself. And so again, that play off each other of these two masterminds, one evil, one good, trying to outsmart each other, it just, it becomes the main focus of the movie, which again, for an adventure film, especially a mystery film, to where it is about the hero, the egotistical sort of puffy, you know, hero that has his faults, going up against the really horrible villain. You know, that's what you want in an adventure film, in an action film of this sort of bombastic nature that it is. So again, the play between these two, and again, I definitely agree with the nostalgia critic here, and that one of the best scenes is the, and I think the best, it goes beyond probably what he says, but the scene where Basil sneaks and finds Radigan's lair, but it turns out to be a trap, that was just a great scene between the two. But I take that even further to, you know, again, the whole lead up to Basil, you know, eventually getting free. The way Barry sort of plays, you know, Basil, you know, he's been hurt. His pride has been hurt, and it's getting to him. And then again, this is where, you know, Val Bettigan as Dawson did a great job of, you know, Dawson realizing what his place is and helping Basil. And, of course, Basil realizing himself, getting, I guess, his pride back. Just, you can feel it in the acting, just all these different emotions, and the actors did a great job in doing that. With that, we're going to move on to story. And again, like I said, the main plot. The main plot of this story is that Professor Radigan wants to create a robot that will declare him the king of all Mousetoria. Which is why he needs the toy maker. It actually does. Here's the thing. It seems like a Sherlock Holmes plot. This seems like a plot that you would read in a Sherlock Holmes movie. You know, a toy maker or a clockmaker or some mechanical genius has been stolen to create this mechanical device that would, you know, help him cue M. Bison from the Street Fighter movie, take over the world. Of course! I really need to get that sound clip. But anyways, but you know, it's really, it feels like a Sherlock Holmes story. More importantly, the story itself is very bombastic and adventure-y, and all the things you need for a kid's mystery movie. And again, I love, like I said, I love the back and forth between Basil and Radigan. You know, the traps that are set up, you know, again, you think, oh, Radigan's making all these mistakes and he's, you know, Basil's coming to him, but, you know, Radigan just outsmarts him a bit, but then Basil's able to turn it around, and it's this back and forth and twist and turn. It's what you want of a mystery movie of this caliber. Like I said, the main story is pretty simple. It's a mystery. Basil wants to take over Mousetoria by creating a fake queen that will declare him king, and Basil has to stop him. It really is that simple. But again, the main plot here, you know, is enhanced by sort of the character development through the series, and the character interactions here. Again, there are two, like I said, there are two ways, I think, to make an interesting movie. You can either be, or should I say, create something very inventive, that's something that people say, wow, I've never sort of seen that story done before. But like I said, for the most part, you'll find that most stories have been done before. So you're usually, if you're doing something inventive, it's an extremely new take on a story that's been done before. Or you can do a story that everybody knows has been done before, excuse me, and you can perfect it. You can do it as perfectly as you can. You know, Sherlock Holmes has been done many a times. It's about you doing that story, doing it as perfectly as you can, and putting your own twist on it. Which is what we see here with Disney. Like I said, it's a very basic mystery story. Not that there really is any mystery at all. But, you know, again, for Disney, it is very compelling. And it is very much a joy to watch. As I said, the main thing that really helps it is the twists and turns of the movie and the character interactions. As I said, Basil, Professor Radigan, the back and forth, really, really good. The interactions with Dawson and Olivia with Basil are another thing that helped this film. Because really it is what sort of separates Basil from Professor Radigan. You know, because to an extent, Basil and Radigan are really two sides of the same coin. One's good, one's evil. But, you know, through his interaction with Dawson and Olivia, and you know, the fact that he cares for him, that stuff, it shows you how he is different from Professor Radigan. He isn't just so obsessed with catching Radigan that, you know, he'll lose sight of things. As opposed to Professor Radigan, who probably shouldn't have done the things he, you know, or at least setting up the trap and wasting time trying to capture Basil. Or at least he should have just killed him right away. Again, his egotistical, prideful mind that wanted to, you know, couldn't decide how to kill Basil. You know, really led to his demise because, again, he eventually got free. And again, that pride, that's what sort of separates him from Basil, and I like that standpoint. And again, the interactions between the, you know, the henchmen and Radigan are really, really good. And I think this is a great segue into sort of the comedy of the series. Because again, I made mention earlier about John Musker and Ron Clements. This being their first, I apologize, folks, their debut, or should I say directorial debut of a Disney animated film, you know, which would be before Little Mermaid, and they also were part of the writing team. And you can really see that comedy here. Again, you just like with the animators, you saw those inklings of the things that would be later used to great stuff in things like Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, Lion King, and so on and so on. Here, with Ron Clements and John Musker, you see the inkling of the stuff, the sort of the comedy that would make things like The Little Mermaid and help Aladdin and Hercules and all the other movies that they would help direct very, very good. You know, again, the kind of, you know, comedy, I'm thinking about the scene, again, like I made mention, when they're in the trap and Basil figures out, and he figured out the right way, and like, oh my god, how is he gonna get out of this? And he's like timed everything right to where Olivia's popped out of the bottom and everything, so he gets it just in time for him to hug him up and go, so everybody say cheese! It's like, that was a good joke. I like it. A lot of the comedy to where interacting with her in Basil's home, I very much liked. I love sort of the comedic bits in the, CD bar. That really made me laugh. a lot of the comedic scenes during the Radigan song, I think that's what helps the Radigan song actually be good, is sort of the comedic bits, one of them being Radigan offing a guy. It's, which sounds horrible to say is funny, but it drives towards the sort of egotisticalism of the villain, and I'm going to walk past there. Again, a lot of the comedy between Olivia and the dog is very cute and very funny. So I thought the comedy really did help provide that layer of sort of relaxation and enjoyment that was needed for the movie not to be too serious. At the end of the day, this is not a perfect movie. It's not the greatest Disney movie, but it's a very good movie. It should be enjoyed. It has a very important place as part of those three films that were really the transition, which is probably a word I was trying to think about earlier, but really was part of that transition, those three films, as I mentioned, Oliver and Company, The Great Mouse Detective, and The Rescuers Down Under, that really transitioned from the sort of downside of Disney of the 70s and 80s, and 60s for that matter, to what would be the golden revival of Disney, starting with Little Mermaid. And more importantly, when you add the fact that it's the first use of the cap system, and again, you have great voice work, and a really solid story, very well done music, very well done animation that even though it's of its age, it's still good. You know, it's good 80s animation. At the end of the day, it's a joy to watch, and I think should be a part of any Disney fans' collection for that matter, definitely. But I think a lot of people should at least check it out. Some will like it, some won't. I enjoy it. I'll watch it again. I think at the end of the day, The Great Mouse Detective gets a 4 out of 5 from me. And a lot of it does have to do, again, it is missing. And this is something about The Rescuers Down Under, The Great Mouse Detective, and Oliver and Company. It is missing that one. It's missing that magic. And again, that was probably the one big problem, the stuff that really, and it came out during this period, and it came out from the 60s all the way through up to Little Mermaid. There was a bit of magic that always felt like it was being missing from the Disney animated films. It just, you know, whether it be Jungle Book, Sword and Stone, and while some of them are beloved, mind you, it's just that missing magic that just reappeared with Little Mermaid that I think is absolutely essential to a great Disney film and a great animated movie. I mean, for one moment, forget the fact that it's a Disney film. Even besides it being a Disney film, there was just that one thing that just felt like, you know, it feels like everything's here and everything's sort of pieced together and it's well done, but it's just, there's just something missing. And that's what this film hit. That's what keeps it from really being on that same level of Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and so on and so on. And like I said, it was really the hard part of reviewing this film, is while I felt like I shouldn't sort of compare it to those films, you know, you do. You know, there's magic in those films that other films don't have. And that is an essential part to what makes it good or not. And this is a good film. It just is missing that magic that's, I think, needed. So that's it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Remember, if you have any comments you want to leave the show, there are several ways you can leave them. You can leave us an email at absolution132@yahoo.com. That's absolution132@yahoo.com. You can also leave us a comment on our Facebook page, which you can find by searching out the Absolution Network on Facebook. Like us and leave us a comment there. And you can always leave us a comment on the website itself, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Remember that you can also, while you're there, check out the Otaku Momentum. Great podcast, doing great stuff. I always suggest their great interview with Kyle Hebert. Kyle Hebert is awesome. And of course, check out all the other 132 production sites, which include Shaft Plus, which is coming back soon. They're releasing little things here and there as they lead up to Shaft Plus premiering, and for that matter, Shaft coming back. Random Redbox Reviews with Chris Stanton, which you can find at www.randomredboxreviews.com. And of course, my other podcasting sites, which includes Tokyo SOS, which reviews every Godzilla movie ever made. I just recently released my review of Godzilla 2000, which I didn't have a lot to say, but I will have a lot to say of the next review, which will actually be coming out this month, which is off the Godzilla the Animated Series from 1998-99, which I had a lot to say. Yes, and I'm going to leave it at this. The animated series was better than the movie. That's it. Well, I'm sure a lot of people are going to say, well, it's not hard for the animated movie to be better than that movie. But that's a whole different story. But, and of course, there's also Comic Book Crazy, a podcasting site which includes Comic Book Crazy, Hexcast, and other comic book inspired podcasts. I may be releasing a new one soon. Still want to wait for that one. But you can find that at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And, of course, while you're there, check out all our friends that are on the sidebar of all our sites. This, of course, includes Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box, and from Crisis to Crisis that he does with Jeffrey Taylor, Brad Douglas' Spider-Man Crawlspeed, Steven Schleicher's Major Spoilers Podcast, and, of course, Scott Gardner's Two True Freaks. That you can all find on the sidebar along with many others. Check them out. They do wonderful stuff. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. We're actually going to talk about the next two episodes, because next episode is episode 50. And we have a... That means there's going to be two episodes out next week. One is going to continue Disney Month. And of course, we have, like I said, there's episode 50 that we'll be celebrating. That I've done 50 episodes. Well, episode 50 is going to be a special episode because coming back to the show will be the legendary Richie Branson. As we talk about a show that is beloved in our hearts. And more importantly, a show I want to re-review since I felt they kind of dropped the ball last year when I reviewed it. And more importantly, would be glad to review it over and over again. That is, of course, Gundam Wing. So episode 50, a special Gundam Wing review with Richie Branson, is coming out next week alongside the continuation of Disney Month with episode 51. And that will include one of my favorite Disney films of all time. Because I can show you the world. Shiny, shimmering, splendid. Tell me, princess, now when did you last let your heart decide? That's right! Grab your magic cart and rub your genie out, which is completely dirty! Wow, I can't believe I said that. But anyways, next week, episode 51, we cover Aladdin. So until next time, my Toonami generation, stay golden.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.